Well, between the 1940s and 1970s, a green revolution in agriculture allowed for the increased production of food crops around the world, which in turn allowed the Earth's population of human beings to, well, explode. Today there is a new green revolution, and some of its adherents are saying there is simply not enough green in the old green revolution agriculture, and that our whole system of agriculture should be redesigned. This leads us to ask, can we green up the green revolution?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 726th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Perth who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Good morning.
Folks, in the 1940s, agriculture scientist Norman Borlaug began introducing high-yield varieties of cereal grains. Irrigation, synthetic fertilizers, pesticides, and modern management techniques to farmers in the developing world. The impact Borlaug's Green Revolution had on the world's agriculture was truly amazing. Consider India for one example. In the early 1960s, India was on the brink of mass famine. Its farmers could only produce 2 tons of rice per acre. But by the mid-1990s, India's farmers were producing 6 tons per acre. During this time, India's population grew from 431 million to well over a billion, thus mirroring the increased production of its rice. And the average person in India today now consumes roughly 25% more calories per day than they did before the Green Revolution. But despite the tremendous success of the Green Revolution, or perhaps because of that success, some say modern agriculture must be redesigned to better justify the needs of a growing population with their environment. This notion was formally outlined in a 2010 report issued by the U.S. National Research Council, and which is now targeted toward making a major impact on the nation's next farm bill. This suggestion that we redesign our entire system of agriculture leads us to ask, can we green up the green revolution? Here to help us find an answer today, we have Professor John Reginald. Professor John is a Regents Professor of the Washington State University up there in Pullman, Washington, and that is wheat country, is it not, John?
Yes, it is. Big wheat country.
Big wheat country. And, of course, one of the reasons it's big wheat country is that you get enough rain to make it big wheat country, right?
That's correct. It's rain-fed wheat, so it's all dry-farmed, and we also grow barley and lentils and peas, too.
Good. So you're an agriculture scientist. You teach agriculture. What is your specialty?
Well, my specialty is soil science and agroecology, and so I teach basic soil science courses, soil management courses, and I also teach an organic gardening and farming class, too.
Okay, good. Now, you're the lead author of this U.S. National Research Council report suggesting a complete redesign of our agriculture. So, before we introduce our next guest, what exactly is this report, and what exactly are you saying?
Well, the report was basically done by the National Academy of Sciences. They asked a group of scientists to put out this report. There were 15 of us, and among those 15, there were 2 farmers across the United States. And we were asked to look at U.S. agriculture in the 21st century and actually come up with, well, are we on the right course? Do we need to make some changes? And what we found is that even though we have increased food production, especially since World War II, across all crops, we have also not addressed other sustainability goals, meaning that with that increase in food production, we have paid for that with environmental consequences like we have areas of soil erosion, soil degradation. We have groundwater overdrawn aquifers. we have surface and groundwaters contaminated with nutrients and pesticides. And I don't mean this is everywhere, but it's in significant mm-hmm. areas. We have dead zones. We have biodiversity loss. And so if conventional mainstream agriculture, if everything were okay, if we were on the right path, we wouldn't have such problems. And mixed in with all that, we actually have farmers who, over the last 20, 30 years, have come up with innovative farming systems that are different from conventional mainstream agriculture.
And that would be a great opportunity to introduce our next guest. But also, I guess I want to go back, and I guess what you're saying, Professor, is that all of that increase in production did not come free.
Correct.
And there it is.
That's right. It did not come free. And so when we think of increasing production, we also have to think of three things: the economic consequences, the environmental consequences, and the social consequences. And if you balance an abundant food supply with those three, you're addressing equally all four sustainability goals, and you're doing it right. So you want farming systems that do that.
Well, our next guest is one person whose family has been addressing that question for quite some time. We have Bryce Lundberg with us. Bryce is one of the principals of Lundberg Family Farms in Richvale, California, and that's rice country, right, Bryce?
That is correct, Michael. We are right in the heart of California's rice-producing area, mm-hmm. Northern California, right in Butte County, north of Sacramento, about 100 miles.
Sure, and rice country, if anybody's driven through the area, it's absolutely beautiful this time of year, getting ready to plant the rice. And your family has really started to do something. It's quite a while ago. How long have you been an organic farmer?
Well, we planted our first organic crop in 1969 and have farmed organically ever since. We haven't been 100% organic, but we practiced the continuous organic production since then, and today we're about 70% organic and 30% in the form of conventional farming we like to call eco-farm, but it's a lower input, sustainable conventional. Well, but organic farming is what we're most known for.
Right. 1969, were you some kind of hippies or something back then? I mean, what, 1969 for organic farming, that's a prehistoric times almost.
Well, you know, it was. For our family, we came from Nebraska in the 30s. Mm-hmm. We saw, or my grandparents, grandmother, grandfather saw what the farming practices had done to the land through the Dust Bowl, and really had a sense that the land needed to be cared for in a way that protected the topsoil. They never stopped growing cover crops. They never would burn off their rice straw, and in doing so, I think when the organic when consumers started asking for organic rice, we were well positioned to say, yes, we know what that is, and we're happy to embrace that.
Hey, that's us. We can do that. Pretty good stuff. Well, let's pay a little homage to the Green Revolution, because it really did transform agriculture in many parts of the world. And in a large part because of the efforts of Norman Borlaug for introducing modern technology to the rest of the world. But let's talk a little bit about the essential core of that modern agriculture is the technology. And correct me if I'm wrong, Professor, but what essentially we're doing here is we're replacing the inputs of time or people in the fields with inputs that cost money.
Well, I think that's that's true. What we've had since World War II, we've had the advent of fertilizers, in particular nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, synthetic, that work quickly with plants. They can take up those nutrients quickly.
And where did we get those?
Well, the creation of nitrogen fertilizer came from the Haber-Bosch process. Two Germans who basically learned how to fix nitrogen from the atmosphere. The atmosphere is 80% nitrogen gas. plants can and bacteria can do this. They can fix nitrogen naturally, but around, I think it was in 1917, 1918, it was discovered that we could actually fix it, and we used it mainly for the manufacture of bombs. And then it was after World War II that we started realizing, hey, we can use this for agriculture, and nitrogen is the key nutrient needed by plants. They need basically at least 16, but nitrogen is the big one.
Really, we're turning swords into plowshares, so to speak.
Right, and so all of a sudden, after World War II, there were fertilizer salespeople going out and selling nitrogen fertilizer to farmers, and farmers seeing this.
Hold that thought. We're going to have to take a quick break.
Sure.
Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about whether we can or cannot green up the green revolution. You know, back when I was a wee tyke living on my grandparents' farm up there in Belfry, Montana, we used to recycle the manures from the farm animals into the fields where we grew our crops. And that was a lot of work, hauling that manure around. And then we discovered, of course, that there was another way of doing it, and that was to take nitrogen fertilizers that essentially are manufactured out of the air, right, Professor Reginald?
Yeah, that's correct. And to do that, it takes fossil fuels. Often it takes natural gas, and so it does take energy. But those fertilizers work quickly, and if used correctly and not over-applied, you can get great results, and they don't have to be, you know, have a negative consequence on the environment.
Mm-hmm. And so the essential core with all of these things is that we really learn to take money inputs like synthetic fertilizers, irrigation, equipment, and take a lot of the man hours out of the field and put money back in and replace them with money inputs. And thus, that's kind of like the core of modern agriculture. Is that a fair enough assumption?
I think that's correct. And I think the goal has always been, or in general, it's generally been, let's put it that way, that we do all this to increase yield. And we don't think about as much the environmental, economic, and social consequences of doing it this way. And however we farm, we have to think of all four of those sustainability goals.
And, of course, during the Green Revolution, we did increase productivity hugely in India and Mexico and in other parts of the developing world, but not so much in Africa for one reason or another. But at any rate, that was the consequence. And as a consequence, we now have a much bigger population than we did before the Green Revolution. But with respect to the Green Revolution, why did your family not take to the modern technologies, or why did it keep those essential core technologies of the past, Bryce Lumberg?
Well, Michael, I think it was because we really had seen how not following those can have a very negative impact on a farm, on a very small scale, on a farm scale, and on a regional scale.
And you talked about your family coming from Oklahoma. Tell people who...
Nebraska, yeah.
Nebraska. Okay.
And in Nebraska, my grandparents had been through the Dust Bowl. They had seen how the farming practices, where you really just opened up the soil and laid it exposed to the elements, could cause it the topsoil to blow away and have profound impacts on a community and on the farm. And so when they came out here to California, my grandparents taught their boys, they had four boys, that cover cropping, crop rotation, never leaving the soil completely bare for an extended period of time, except to address the planting season, it was critical. And so, and building organic matter into the soil helps hold it. And so, those became a foundation for our farm, and continue to be a foundation for our farm today.
And yet, those around you didn't quite buy into that, right?
Well, you know, I think for a period of time they did, but would see how conventional tools and fertilizers and pesticides could bring significant, what they would say, significant value to their farms, and would take those tools in and maybe stop practicing crop rotation, cover cropping, and straw incorporation. Although I must say, in the last 10-15 years, the farmers in this area, in the rice growing area, have really switched completely to straw incorporation, and have seen the benefits of returning the organic matter to the soil, both in the tilth of the ground and as well as the nutrients that the straw holds. And yeah. So I would say in some ways it's has been a somewhat of a return to some of those ideals.
Well, good. Professor Reginald, as the lead author of this paper which is pointing out that perhaps we should consider a whole redesign of our agriculture system, what did you, when you looked at conventional agriculture, what did you see as being wrong with respect to its total productivity?
Well, what we found is since World War II, farm output, so yield, has increased about 160%. Okay, so that's great, but it has been at the cost of some of these negative environmental consequences that I talked about, the overdrawn aquifers, the eroded soils, dead zones, and also we are losing mid-sized commercial farms. Large farms are on the increase, and actually small farms are on the increase,
right,
but
right.
Mid-sized commercial farms are on the decrease. Rural communities, some of those are closing down. So if we didn't have those issues, you'd just say, well, hey, conventional farming is doing great. It's the answer. We do have those issues, and they are significant. We also have farmers in the United States, like Bryce, who are innovative, and they have developed these alternative systems, and those systems are, for example, organic is one. The other 30% of his land that he farms, we would probably call, he calls it an eco farm, we would probably call it integrated, where he's using these crop rotations and cover crops. Basically, those kinds of practices are used in organic farming systems. They want to build the soil, but at the same time, if they want to come in with some synthetic fertilizers or pesticides in a limited fashion, they can do that. So they're using the best of both worlds, and that is good. That's innovative. We have alternative livestock production systems where the animals are grass-fed most of the time. So there are these systems that we see in place that address these four sustainability goals, and they've been, you know, they're growing, but they're still not widespread. So why not support those systems if we're going to have a farm bill, which comes out every 4 or 5 years, supporting commodity crops? Why not have that money? Let's restructure it so it supports these innovative farmers.
Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like one of your principal criticisms then in your paper or in your basic fundamental assertion is that we've neglected to total up all of the costs of our production. And so when we do measure our productivity, we see that we're up 160%, and yet we haven't calculated the costs. So our net profit is not exactly measuring up to the increase in productivity.
That is correct. And we need to think about, we're farming these lands now. We want to be good stewards. What do we want to hand down to our children and grandchildren? We want to hand down productive farmlands. And so we want systems in place that don't have negative environmental consequences, that are good socially, and that can make money and still provide adequate or abundant supplies of food. We have those systems today in place, but they're not the dominant systems.
Bryce?
Well, I would agree. And, I would say one of the real blessings for our family is that as we have adopted these kinds of farming practices, we've been able to engage a consumer who is interested in those and wants to support that and will pay a premium for those kinds of farm goods or that kind of product. And in what Dr. Reginald said as far as what are we going to return to our kids or what are we going to leave for our kids, one of the things is I think we need to be farming in a way that our kids want to adopt and could be proud of and want to come back to. And by being able to farm in a way that is supported by the local community and by a consumer base that comes and gets that product, we're able to attract our kids back to the farm and say, there is something here for the future.
All right, there we're going to take a quick break, but when we get back, we're going to go to that future. Folks, this is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with John Reginald, Bryce Lundberg, and you right back. Well, folks, over the last half century, we've had an incredible explosion, a green revolution in technology that's allowed for a huge increase in the productivity of our principal food crops. And as a consequence, we've had a tremendous explosion in our population. In India alone, more than doubled between the 1940s and between the 1960s and the 1990s, from 400,000 to over a billion. Boom, a tremendous explosion. And so we look at this green revolution and think, oh my goodness, what an incredible benefit to humankind. And yet there are some among us who are saying, well, wait a minute, we're not really measuring the true costs of this increase in productivity. And when we look at the impact of that conventional post-World War II agriculture on our environment, we go, well, maybe there are some costs here that have to be figured. And so someone got together and put together a suggestion that we completely redesign agriculture and targeting this effort to the 2012 Farm Bill. So that's the question on the table today. Can we green up the green revolution so that we can feed ourselves without destroying our environment? Is that a fair way of putting it, Professor John Reginald?
Yeah, I think I think that is. And what we're really saying is we have, thanks to these farmers with these innovative systems, we have these systems in place, and we just need to make them more widespread that are sustainable systems.
Well, that's a fun notion, and I think Bryce Lundberg touched on that earlier when he talked about consumers. I always thought that the key to change is not in farmers, you know, in getting farmers to change, but really it's in getting people to change how they eat. And farmers will follow happily along like happy little boys and girls. Yes, sir, we'll take care of you. Bryce, what do you say?
I believe that. I believe that the American consumers, or many in the American consumers, want greener agriculture and are willing to support that. And we see that in the growth of organic farming. We see that in the growth of farmers markets, in the movement to eat local and to know your farmer. And so I think farmers are responsive to that. But I do agree with Dr. Reginald that we need the support of a farm bill that will bring tools and techniques I think so much of the public funding of agriculture has been in the area of conventional and supporting the ideals of the the international kind of conglomeration that is supporting a very intensive agriculture, and I think our gains in greening up the green revolution could be made in our public dollars being used for these kinds of projects to learn how to make gains without these additional costs to the environment, to society, and I think we need that kind of shift that would give the or would spend the public dollars toward these kind of public good, this kind of public good.
Yeah, maybe they could send a few million my way too while they're at it. Come to think of it. Gee whiz. You know, I got a disparaging word here earlier when I sent out a press release regarding this show. I had a interesting email from a friend who sent me an article about a couple in the Midwest, a farm couple in the Midwest, who ran out of money to buy gasoline for their equipment and so turned to turning their steers into their plows and running their plows. And there was a person there who taught them how to do this, how to manage their cattle to turn them into work animals. And this person got his training by working with peasant farmers in Africa. And so the comment was, is this where we're headed with respect to green technologies? Are we going back to ancient times and labor-intensive technologies? Is that what we're talking about, Professor?
Oh, I don't think we're going back at all. I mean, there's certainly, you know, some basic practices, crop rotation. The idea of crop rotations has been around for a long time. Farmers today that are innovative, you know, people think, for example, of organic farmers. Well, some people think that it's a step backwards. No, these farmers are modern farmers who use modern equipment, who use equipment that some conventional farmers don't even use. They use computers. And these alternative systems like organic farming or these alternative livestock production systems, they are more information intensive, more knowledge intensive. More information is needed to do it, and that's one of the hindrances of other farmers adopting these systems, because in moving toward these innovative systems, you're relying less on synthetic pesticides and fertilizers. You don't have that arsenal, and it's much more difficult. And another factor that people need to realize, I think some people think, well, you know, why don't farmers just make the changes? It must be easy. People don't realize that farmers, there, you know, have so many factors that are influencing their decisions beyond just the fact, well, okay, they live in an area where they can grow certain kinds of food. That can be a limitation. Mm-hmm. Are they renting the land? Do they own the land? Another. But they are affected by federal, state, local policies, agricultural, energy, environmental policies. They're affected by markets, you know, they're affected by the price of fertilizers and pesticides, and all these factors go into their decisions on what they're going to do, and so we need to be thinking about that.
Amen. Let me back up a little bit, and it seems to be like you're suggesting that people who use these organic technologies or these alternative technologies must be smarter than those who use the conventional technologies. Did I hear you say that?
I wouldn't say they're smarter. I would say that the systems that they're farming with, they require more knowledge. So, for example, if you're an organic farmer, you know that you may have disease or pest problems or weed problems, and you know you're not going to be able to go out there instantaneously if you have a weed problem and spray it. The organic farmers don't have that. You have to use crop rotations and ground cover mechanisms and cultural controls, and you have to be thinking of these things ahead of time to make sure that you don't come up with those problems. And so it's more of a prevention type management, and it's a new way of thinking. And so when you transition, the hardest period for any farmer to transition to these newer systems is going to be in the first 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Bryce Lundberg, your family's been organic farming for a long, long time. I'd like to ask, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to ask you, do you think it takes more intelligence or more knowledge or more attention to be a good alternative organic farmer than simply flying on some pesticides? Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about greening up, the green revolution, that period of time when we brought modern technology to the developing world and we experienced a tremendous explosion in crop productivity, but it cost. And we're talking about those costs and how we can ameliorate those costs so that we can really get some true profit out of this technology rather than just increased productivity. I am Michael Olson. We have Professor John Reginald, who's a lead author of the study, Washington State University, Pullman, Washington. Bryce Lundberg, Lundberg Family Farms, Richfield, California. We have rice, we have wheat, and we have you. We will be right back. Well, folks, what do you think? Can we green up the green revolution? Can we make our agriculture more environmentally friendly so the true costs of our increased production don't outweigh the cost of that production and turn a profit into a loss just by virtue of the impact it has on our environment? That's the question we have on the table today, and we're talking with Professor John Reginald, who is a Regents Professor at Washington State University, Pullman, up there in Wheat Country. Bryce Lundberg, whose Lundberg Family Farms have been farming rice in California's great Central Valley for many years, Richfield, California. And, of course, we are talking with you as well. You're invited to participate. Pick up your phone and join us today. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We're talking about the food you eat and how it's grown and produced. Professor Reginald, you were talking a little bit, or you rang my chimes when you started talking about the rules and regulations that farmers have to contend with. Here on California's Central Coast, we have an interesting situation in which the government is trying to control the water runoff, running off agriculture, because it runs right into the Monterey Bay Marine Sanctuary, which is a no-no to have any bad stuff in the water there. So the government is trying to get farmers to come to grips with the fact that they can't have any runoff. And so they're asking farmers to plant riparian corridors along their water ditches so that there are plants there that will help clean up the toxic materials in the fields. But then there's another government agency that's telling farmers that, well, you can't have any plants growing on the riparian corridors because that will harbor animals that may be harboring the E. coli 0157H7 and other toxic bacteria and viruses. So you have one government agency telling farmers to do one thing and another government agency telling farmers that they have to do exactly the other thing. So my question to you is, when you redesign agriculture, are you going to make it impossible for new people to start farming?
No, I don't think so. But you brought up a great point, and there are these conflicts between regulations. They do occur. We were talking earlier about the Farm Bill, and that is probably the main policy driver for farmers in the United States. Mm-hmm. But there are others. There are other local and state policies that affect farmers. There are all these environmental regulations. And so when we talk about agriculture sustainability, it's a complex area, and we have to integrate into the sustainability conversation debates about these environmental regulations. We have to include debates on biofuels, immigration reform, climate change, trade agreements, energy policies. So you can just see by that list, oh my goodness, this isn't something that's simple. And when you talk about environmental, say, damage, one of the biggest players, and in some cases maybe the biggest player, is agriculture, you know, because sure, it occupies a lot of the land.
Sure. And so onto agriculture is going to go so many of these new rules and regulations. When you're talking about completely redesigning, you're completely redesigning how farmers live their lives. Bryce Lundberg, a good example. Farmers in the California Central Valley used to burn their rice straw, right?
that used to be the custom, and now it is not. And it used to be that farmers wanted to be able to use, you know, whatever maybe herbicide or pesticide mm-hmm. that they wanted to use and be able to release the water. And that is not custom anymore. I would say in Northern California, the rice farmers have become very sensitive to environmental issues, just where they are relative to the population, where they are relative to the salmon and the delta issues, where they are relative to air issues, and then also understanding that their land is the primary wetland for the migrating birds, ducks and geese, and that 60% of the food that the birds eat come from the rice lands. And so I think it is one of the big transformations that it can be happening from maybe what rice looked like in California in the 60s to what it looks like in mm-hmm. in 2011. And plus, I would say, I think in California now we have maybe 70, 80 organic farmers, organic rice farmers, farming organic rice up to 5-6% of the California organic rice crop is organic.
Let me ask you this.
And that's growing.
Can you hold your total production and still be using environmentally friendly technologies?
You know, we do not generally meet the county averages in our organic production. Although I would say our organic rice production has been coming up, and we are so in favor of continuous improvement. Mm-hmm. Continuous improvement is one of the core values of our farm. And so the idea that we need to go back in time, I think you never want to give up those positive farming techniques, but we don't want to necessarily feel like we're going back in time.
You really do have to be smarter, don't you?
You know what? I think you have to be willing to take more risks. And, you know, farming is a risky business just in and of itself. And most farmers I know are risk averse. So I think that's why often they want to use techniques or materials that can lock in or reduce that risk. But I think we do have to be willing to take more risk to understand how to use these natural controls effectively and continue to raise the bar in our organic production.
Right back. Do stay tuned. Well, folks, can we completely redesign our agriculture and put some green into the green revolution by which we've been feeding ourselves for at least past 50 years or so? Can we use the Farm Bill to completely redesign how we do things? And can we do so in a way that will allow us to allow new people to come into the business of agriculture and continue to feed us? You know, one of the things that I've come to understand is how government and rulemaking and lawmaking is often used by vested interests to restrict competition. You know, you hire some lobbyists and you encourage the lawmakers and the rulemakers and the regulation makers to do things your way, and your way being a way that prevents others from being able to go in and do business, and thus you can restrict your competition by working closely with government. Professor John Reginald, how on earth can we go about completely redesigning our agriculture and prevent vested interests from restricting competition and thus keeping new people from becoming part of agriculture?
Well, you know, and that is the question. It's going to be very difficult. The Farm Bill, which comes out, but the Farm Bill is probably the biggest player that affects our food production system as far as policy goes. And a new version comes out next year. So it is being worked on right now. And believe me, there are a number of lobbyists in Washington, you know, lobbying for whatever they want. In a lot of cases, it'll be for, you know, mainstream agriculture. And so we really need to change the spending, especially there are good things about the Farm Bill, but we really need to reallocate the spendings for these mainstream commodity subsidies that can mask market and environmental risk. And we need to reallocate those to support these innovative alternative farming systems and also to encourage markets for sustainability brand products. And one other thing, you know, we talk a lot about this policy. The consumer plays a role, too. The consumer votes with their dollars, and they need to take responsibility for what they eat and how much they eat.
Amen to that. Now, Bryce Lundberg, how many lobbyists does the Lundberg Family Farms have working on the farm bill?
Well, we have zero. It, you know, a lot of times my and I think our family's approach has been, if the government just won't come in and hurt us or get in our way, we can do it here on the farm with a relationship with our consumers, with our customers. But sometimes we come up against things we have a hard time solving, and that's when I think government can be of great help. And like Dr. Reginald said, the consumer can play a huge part, both in how the consumer chooses to buy or what the consumer chooses to buy, but also telling their representatives that this is the kind of food they want to buy and what kind of food they'd like the American farmer encouraged to grow.
And you'll listen, right?
We will. I think farmers do. I think farmers are innovators, and farmers can change. Although one of the things that is really quite a dilemma and I think very difficult for me to engage or understand is how in such short time we've lost so much of the diversity of our food in the Midwest.
And we're going to have to leave it because we're out of time. I want to thank both of you, John Reginald, Regents Professor, Washington State University, Pullman, and Bryce Lundberg, Lundberg Family Farms, Richfield, California. And thank you all for tuning in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.